KALW.
One resident of Marina Bay that I talked to, he says that Richmond has a branding problem.
Residents in Richmond's District 5 are looking to city leaders for solutions.
They feel like because of things like illegal dumping, people are not showing the pride and purpose that is Richmond's motto.
Calling for investment in arts and culture in one of the Bay Area's more industrial cities. Then we hear how stories can impact the practice of medicine.
So it was really my inability and unwillingness to obtain his story that led me to make a bureaucratic mistake.
The next episode of Book It. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Election day is almost here. There's a lot to pay attention to nationally, but we can't sleep on the local issues. To help Bay Area voters, we've partnered with local newsrooms to bring listeners comprehensive news and election coverage. Today, we speak with reporter Holly McDeed. She freelances for Richmond's side and recently spoke with voters in District 5 about what changes they want to see in their community. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke with Holly.
We can't talk about this race without talking about the incumbent who won't be running this year, and that's Gail McLaughlin. Tell us a little bit about the incumbent and, for example, why she didn't decide to seek another term.
Yeah, I mean, so Gail McLaughlin has been a pretty critical figure in Richmond politics for, almost two decades. She actually is the founder of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which she started in 2003. That's this organization that argues that corporations like Chevron have too much power in society. She was a two-term Green Party mayor of Richmond, returned to the Richmond City Council in 2020. And she is not running this year because she is running for lieutenant governor of California. So she wanted to focus on that campaign. So she resigned earlier this year.
Who is running to succeed her? Tell me about the candidates.
So there are two candidates running to succeed her. That includes Ahmaud Anderson. So he's actually the son of two former Richmond mayors, and he is competing with someone named Sue Wilson, who is the candidate that has been endorsed by McLaughlin, as well as the Richmond Progressive Alliance. She is a union organizer and nonprofit consultant.
Ahmaud Anderson, he used to play football for the University of California. Could you tell me a little bit more? Now, Ahmaud Anderson, he's an African-American, long roots in Richmond. How has he been trying to appeal to the electorate?
Ahmaud Anderson really has framed himself as a Richmond native. He's worked as a human resources director. He's was a leader at a nonprofit, Goodwill Industries. And so he, in his campaign, has credited his family with passing down a legacy of social justice and public service. And he's focusing on issues like public safety, budget oversight, and housing affordability.
Now, his opponent is running with the endorsement of the incumbent and former mayor. What is her campaign platform?
When Gail McLaughlin left, she said she was passing on the torch to Sue Wilson. So having the endorsement of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, I think, says a lot about the issues she cares about. She's also campaigning on expanding affordable housing, as well as clean energy jobs and rebuilding downtown.
You know, I love Marina Bay in Richmond. I walk there, ride my bike there. That is the heart of District 5. You went there. Who did you talk to there, and what were they saying about the election?
One resident of Marina Bay that I talked to, he says that Richmond has a branding problem, and he really wants the next candidate, the next person to represent District 5, to do more to sell Richmond to the world, to sell Richmond for all the good it has as far as arts and culture and places like the Marina Bay. He also wants to see someone who can really put more investment into programs that prevent crime. Another Marina Bay resident I talked to is worried, as many residents are, about air pollution. He has an air monitor on his house to gauge the air quality, and he says air quality is pretty good in the Marina Bay, but he still worries about the overall impact of corporations like Chevron.
You also spent some time in Laurel Park. What did you find there? What did some of the prospective voters have to say?
So when I went to Laurel Park in Richmond, I ran into two people who have been described as Laurel Park royalty because of their strong community presence over the years. So that includes someone named Myrtle Braxton. Her late husband is actually the person who the park in Laurel Park, which is the Abraham Braxton Park, is named after. And I ran into her daughter, Kara Braxton, who is a flight attendant. And so they shared similar concerns as a lot of voters in Richmond around homelessness, worries about sideshows and illegal dumping, and kind of a similar message of they want political leaders who can make people proud of Richmond and, I guess get local pride going in the sense of they feel like because of things like illegal dumping, people are not showing the pride and purpose that is Richmond's motto.
Now, elections in Richmond and as in several other Bay Area communities, voter participation has generally been low. What does it look like this year? Do you see a little bit more enthusiasm? Have you talked with people who may not have voted before who are going to vote this year? What are some of the reasons behind what will send some folks to the polls?
Well, the people I talk to happen to be big believers in voting. So maybe not representative, but the people I talked to, Myrtle Braxton, for instance, is on the board of the League of Women Voters, and she says that everyone in her church in Richmond is registered to vote, and she said that they know better not to register to vote. So she personally and her daughter talked about how people have died for the right to vote, people have been beaten for the right to vote, and so that's really drilled down in who she is and what she stands for, that voting is something important and that people should remember the history of what it took to be able to vote in the first place.
All right. Now, the Richmond Progressive Alliance has held sway in the city and city government for a long time. Do you see any change in that in the elections in November?
Well, it could be interesting to see who ends up winning District 5 in terms of we have this candidate, Sue Wilson, who has their endorsement of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, is really proud to be associated with that group. And then we have a candidate, Ahmaud Anderson, who is not with the Richmond Progressive Alliance. And so who wins District 5 could play a role in what kind of representation we see there.
That was Holly McDeed, freelance reporter for Richmond Side, speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. You can find a link to her coverage of Richmond at kalw.org/crosscurrents. And don't touch that dial. KALW's show Bay Made will be airing an excerpt from our Black Voices in the Elections panel right after Crosscurrents at 11:30. You're listening to Crosscurrents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. When we get medical checkups, we are used to our doctors measuring our breath, blood pressure, and temperature. But some are going further by asking a patient about their experiences with poverty and racism. We hear about This Way to Diagnose in Book It, our weekly look at Bay Area books and authors. This week, host Angie Coiro's guest is Dr. Dean David Schillinger. His new book is about the power of stories in medicine. Here's Angie.
And it is packed with tales from Dr. Schillinger's years as a medical student, as a primary care physician at SF General, as co-founder of UCSF's Center for Vulnerable Populations, and as an advocate for populations with compromised access to healthcare. He's written Telltale Hearts, A Public Health Doctor, His Patients, and the Power of Story. The key is understanding not just the medical needs of a patient, but who they are and how their lives work. If you could pick one story to tell us that to this day you wish you could go back and change your lack of ability to listen, what would that be?
Oh, yeah, there's a very clear story. And the story starts out with the antithesis of that story, which is the story of my great uncle, who was a soldier in the German army, a Hungarian Jew who was fighting for the Germans in World War I. And he was in a trench and he was attacked by a Russian soldier and was about to be bayoneted to death. And the Russian Jew looked him in the eye and essentially recognized him as a fellow Jew and asked him if he was Jewish. And my great uncle, you know, nodded vigorously. And instead of bayoneting him to death, he, you know, grabbed him by the lapels and took him as a prisoner of war. It's the ultimate sort of seeing the other as oneself. And, you know, there was an event that happened to me. There was a very, very common syndrome, still common today, of patients who use intravenous drugs who present to the hospital with a fever. Mm-hmm. And back then we used to call them shooter with a fever. And, you know, it would sometimes be every one in four patients that you admitted was a shooter with a fever, which is now a derogatory term that we don't use.
Yeah.
Because you're not naming the patient. You're not getting to know who they are, who their family is, who their children is, what their story is. And so to make a long story short, we had two people admitted with that same diagnosis. Your job is to obtain blood cultures, which is why the chapter is called The Culture of Blood. Obtain two blood cultures, make sure that they are not growing bacteria that could reflect a serious heart infection transmitted by injecting dirty drugs. Mm-hmm. And once those are cleared, discharge them from the hospital and hope that they can quit their habit. And in my sleep-deprived state and in my inhumanity at not sort of obtaining a real story from this guy as to who he was and just naming him as shooter with a fever A and shooter with a fever B, I made the mistake of interpreting the wrong blood cultures and discharging him back to the nursing home, and then him representing to our hospital in full-blown endocarditis, which is this infection of the heart, which led to his prompt death. So it was really my inability and unwillingness to obtain his story that led me to make a bureaucratic mistake that reflected not only my inability to understand our shared humanity, but a lot of implicit bias related to his race. He was Black. He was pretty unbearable when he was in opiate withdrawal. He was an unpleasant patient to take care of. And he was an intravenous drug user, which is something that I'm not. And so I think all of those things conspired to lead to a fatal error. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the case of my great uncle, you know, in the throes of war, in a similar kind of trenches, his life was saved because of the opposite, because he was recognized not as the other, but as the same. And so I think it's a very powerful force that we need to resist when we are taking care of the other. And story can bridge that.
I don't want to jump too far ahead, but in the latter part of the book, it focuses on the phenomenon of diabetes and how much of that is a product of the life that you're living, you know, which socioeconomic category you were born into, access exactly. to healthcare, access to good food. And it strikes me that one of the most tempting things about not recognizing humanity, if I can look at that person and say, well, she's shoving sugar down her throat, not because some corporation is at the hand of that, not because we all need to make socioeconomic changes, she's deciding to eat. That's her problem. He's deciding to smoke. That's his problem. In your situation, I can see why it would be tempting to say, this guy's shooting up drugs. Of course he's going to have endocarditis. What else is going to happen? So you can see the temptation of a human being to draw that line and make them other.
Absolutely. It's a very strong pull. And in the case of diabetes, which you mentioned, I think we have an ongoing narrative in this country that it is people's individual choices that lead them to develop type 2 diabetes, as opposed to the life course exposure that they've had since early childhood to mm-hmm. added sugar in beverages, growing up in low-income neighborhoods where the availability of sugar-sweetened beverages is ubiquitous, where poverty is ubiquitous and alternative choices are unavailable, and where targeted marketing takes place and targeted discounts take place, all in the hopes of getting people essentially addicted to sugary beverages. And that's, you know, that phenomenon is manifested in a number of stories in the book. There's the story of Marshawn, who lost his foot at a young age. And then there's the story of Melanie, who really is the lead actor in part three, who developed type 2 diabetes, which normally we think of as like grandma's disease, right? Mm-hmm. In her early 30s, when I got to know her, and very rapidly developed some of the complications of type 2 diabetes, visual problems, loss of sensation of her feet, a minor stroke, depression, all of these things leading her to be disabled at a very young life. Most of the exposures happening in her first 12 years of life, when it's not like she's got a lot of discretion in choosing what she's going to consume.
Right.
And she grew up in the Bayview. And if you look at the geocoded maps of the Bayview, though, that was redlined. That's where the highest proportion of sugar-sweetened beverages are consumed in the city. That's the lowest socioeconomic status location in the city. And it's also where the highest rates of diabetes hospitalizations for complications are happening. So it's all geolocated in these hotspots in San Francisco, which really does, you know, call into question this idea of rugged individualism, which is at the core of our belief system in America.
It's all up to you.
Happens.
Yeah. You know, I have to tell you, there were a couple jaw-dropping moments in the book. That was the first one for me, when you showed all the inverted T's, the shapes
yes,
of what's happening geographically in the city,
yeah.
The maps. It's one
wild.
Thing to say, well, you know, where there's lower income, there's more illness. That's one thing to hear that as a theory. It's another thing to have it so in your face demonstrated.
Yeah, it's visually very, very compelling. And to see that these are the same maps again and again, showing different forms of marginalization and oppression mm-hmm. showing up, looking the same in maps of different variables.
Yeah.
And Melanie's story had a very tragic ending, which led to my getting very, you know, politically involved in the fight against diabetes. On her 40th birthday, she came to see me in clinic, which I was surprised by because most people on their birthday aren't going to go see the doctor, but whatever, and hard to get appointments at San Francisco General Hospital. And I asked her what she was going to do for her birthday, and she said she was going to do the thing that she loves to do the most, which is go to the water slide park in the East Bay in Concord, and was really looking forward to that. And her partner took her there, and a couple of months later at her follow-up visit, Melanie wasn't there, but her partner was, and her partner told me the tragic story of what happened to Melanie at the water slide park, which is because she had lost feeling at the bottom of her feet from the diabetes. She didn't know when she was standing on the staircase that she was burning the bottom of her feet.
Mm.
And you know how hot those steps can get when you're at a water slide park. And one thing led to another. The burns led to gangrene. Gangrene led to amputation. Amputation led to sepsis. And within 2-3 days, she had passed away from a completely preventable disease, a disease that is really purveyed by very large corporations that, work to addict us to their products.
I do want to get to the activism that spurred in you. But let me first draw that connective thread between here you are, a bouncing baby doctor who doesn't know really yet the value of listening to story, all the way to Melanie, where you know her story, because by then you had learned to listen, you had learned to ask the right questions.
Right.
Tell me about a story in the middle. Tell me about someone where you had learned that value of listening to story and used it to diagnose more effectively than you had before.
Well, I'll tell a simple story and a more complicated story. The simple story is one of John T., who had severe hypertension, high blood pressure. I mean, very severe, 240 over 140, again and again. And, you know, I was treating him with 6 or 7 medications. I was doing expensive diagnostic workups to figure out why he had such high blood pressure. And I would repeatedly ask him to bring in his medications so that I could review them with him. And he wouldn't do it. But he was reporting that he was taking the medications. And finally, in what I call a therapeutic confrontation, I said to him, listen, I need to see these medication bottles. And if you don't bring them in, I'm going to have to fire you as a patient, which of course one can't do and one I would never do.
He didn't need to know that.
Right. He didn't need to know that. And at the next appointment, he brought in a shoebox full of, you know, dozens of pill bottles, none of them open, some of them prescribed by doctors who had preceded me. And I asked him, you know, what's going on here, Mr. T? And he said, well, sheepishly, you know, I never told you that I just can't swallow pills. And so I had never really, I had assumed that our treatment plan was copacetic, and I had never really asked him, how's it going with those, you know, with those pills?
Right.
And so we were able to switch him to two liquid preparations of two different medications, and his blood pressure was fine. Unfortunately, he had accrued a lot of damage, I'm sure, in the interim period. A more complicated story was a patient of mine who was admitted to the hospital. She was a grandmother of five, admitted, had diabetes, was on insulin, and was admitted to the hospital with very low blood sugar, which is quite unusual. You know, usually with diabetes, you have high blood sugar, but sometimes people can either overdose on their insulin or you know, not eat enough and while they're taking their insulin. And she was hospitalized for a number of days for hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, which is quite unusual. Usually you can turn that around pretty quickly and discharge the patient, you know, within the day. But this was just not turning around. And the inpatient team couldn't figure it out. They did everything in the book and the textbook to, you know, to try to figure it out, and they couldn't figure it out. And sent her back to me, and I, you know, I just kind of went through my list of social vulnerabilities of, you know, what could be going on here, you know, and very carefully listening to her, like, is she food insecure? You know, are you preferentially giving food to your grandchildren and withholding food from yourself and still giving yourself insulin? No, I know the lines in which churches to stand in to get the food. She was very resourceful. Okay, limited health literacy. Could it be that you're drawing up the wrong amount of insulin in your syringe and injecting, essentially overdosing? And so I brought an empty syringe and a little bottle of saline, and she showed me exactly to the T, you know, how much she uses. So it wasn't that. And finally I asked her, you know, you're the expert here, you know, what do you think is going on? And I had been taking care of her for over 10 years at this point. And then she admitted to me that she had an abusive husband who would use her insulin as a weapon, either withhold it as a means of control or inject it when he was particularly angry with her. And in this case, he had injected massive doses of long-acting insulin, and that's the last she remembered. And we were able to work with our social worker and behaviorists and involve law enforcement with some careful confidential conversations, and ultimately get her out of a very, very messy situation. But that's one example of really carefully not only listening but being a detective,
right?
To try to, you know, being both Sherlock Holmes and Watson at the same time, you know, to try to figure out what's ailing the patient.
That was KLW's Angie Coiro and her guest, Dr. Dean David Schillinger, discussing his book, Telltale Hearts, A Public Health Doctor, His Patients, and the Power of Story. We'll have a link to Dr. Schillinger's media project, The Bigger Picture, at klw.org/crosscurrents. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. We'll go to a basement venue in the Castro that's over 100 years old.
And as long as I've been here since, you know, and as far as I know, even from the late 80s, early 90s, it's always been a spot for local music.
Keeping local music alive tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Crystal Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.